Hello, welcome, and thank you for joining us in the Restorative Lens podcast, where we bring together voices in the restorative justice community to share insight, practices, and perspective.
Each series of the Restorative Lens will be focusing on different topics within the field of restorative justice and give a space to hear from those who are most directly impacted or involved in the work.
The Restorative Lens is supported under the National Center on Restorative Justice, and we are your hosts. I am Tomei Douglas.
And I am Alana Ojibwe. We're so excited to share with you the launch of this first series, which features the voices of several authors from the book Colorizing Restorative Justice. Colorizing Restorative Justice is a collection of 18 different essays by 20 practitioners and scholars of color, exploring the issues of racism and colonization within the field of restorative justice and restorative practices.
We hope you enjoy listening. My name is Tomei, and I am excited to have you here with us on the Restorative Lens.
Hi. Nice to officially say hello again. My name is Alana Ojibwe.
Great. It's great to be here with you both.
Thank you. So can you just introduce yourself, Christina?
Sure. I'm Christina Parker, and right now I'm an assistant professor in a department called Social Development Studies at the University of Waterloo. I sort of have fallen into restorative justice work through my research in peacebuilding education. So that's really where I've come from. I did my PhD in education at the University of Toronto, and also did my teaching degree there as well, and have deep interest in social studies education as well as literacy. So that's sort of where I'm coming from in terms of my background. And yeah, I have been doing restorative work and in schools for and related to peace building for over a decade now, either as a teacher or a practitioner or a researcher. So I have really felt privileged to be able to go into different school settings and work with young people and teachers who are doing really great and wonderful things. And I hope to share some of that with you today.
Yeah. And just briefly also, so you talk about the peace building circles and who's sort of in and out of those circles in diverse classrooms in your chapter in the book. I was wondering if you could just give a little background of how did you get involved with the book?
Yeah, so I was sort of doing this work, it feels like, in speaking with all the other contributors from Colorizing Restorative Justice, that many people were, and whether as a practitioner or researcher doing work around restorative justice, we're working, in silos, feeling pretty isolated. And because it is somewhat isolating to be in the space that is, in some cases, predominantly led by, white-led institutions. And I think in sort of pushing back against that and realizing that, so much of a restorative approach is really coming from Indigenous culture and looking at, the Afrocentric roots as well. I think the editor, Edward Valendra, really, put out this call, and I didn't know him at the time. I only know him now through the book. And when I saw the call, and a few people had forwarded it to me as well, I was like, oh, wow, this is happening. Like, this is amazing. And, it sort of almost affirmed, whether, my abstract was accepted or not, it was sort of an affirmation that, people are paying attention to diversity and difference within this space. Because when I had first started looking into restorative justice as sort of a topic that I wanted to explore actually in my PhD early on, and I had written a proposal to explore restorative justice, but didn't really feel as though it was the right place for me at the time to go as deeply. And part of that was because I didn't feel I wanted to connect more to looking at anti-racist work and seeing the need for looking at difference and diversity, and wasn't really feeling that I was seeing that within the literature. So sort of stepped back and looked more at critical peace building education, which brought it a little bit closer to home. But I'm grateful now that I can bring the two together. But, I submitted an abstract to the book and was grateful that I was accepted. And through a series of phone conversations that that they organized, we were able to, you know, sort of build a community and come together as a community to talk about this work and the importance of it and really think about our chapters individually. So, you know, I wrote it in terms of, you know, thinking about my own position as a researcher, as a practitioner, and thinking about how I could frame things in a way that could potentially support schools and teachers and administrators and leading a restorative approach that is very attuned to difference, diversity, and inclusion. So that's sort of my path into the Colorizing Restorative Justice Project. And really do feel now that a movement has started. And I think many more people are, you know, are interested and at the very least have the confidence or affirmation that it is something we need to pay attention to. And it is the book that could and should be recommended when you were trying to coach and teach people about restorative justice.
Yeah, absolutely. I think your chapter is such a great example of one that really lays out some really clear, I think, and helpful tools for teachers and people really working in these schools and doing these programs, because I think it's so good at identifying. Tomei and I were checking in just briefly before this, but even things like when you go into talking about the importance of silence and how much of an action that can be by choice and what that says, and just different ways of reading dynamics and knowing, you know, a bit more context about your students to see sort of the why behind certain behaviors and just developing better tools to facilitate those conversations. I think yours was, I think the whole book should be something that's a required book for so many people in this work, but especially for educators. I just think yours was such an incredible chapter with some really helpful things to think about and hopefully implement.
Yeah, thanks, Elena. Yeah, I'm hearing from, you know, from the publisher and others that people are finding the book quite useful. And I know in the Toronto area, at least, many principals and an entire school district actually in Ontario bought, I think, 150 copies for their teachers. And so I think people are seeing the need for this work. And I feel like as though, you know, they're even still, though, I think, you know, I'm currently doing research in two different boards that have a restorative approach, one more focused than another. And it is it's interesting how, you know, teachers can go through an entire training, 3-day training, and not talk about race and not talk about inclusion and talk about difference. And, you know, this idea that we could continue to train teachers to perpetuate a model that continues to exclude through restorative justice, to me, doesn't feel like a restorative approach. So, yeah.
That's something that I actually really appreciated in your chapter. I love your chapter.
Thank you.
So much that, so I, you know, in all transparency, I'm actually submitting an assignment for one of my classes, and it's, I received an extension, and I'm glad because I'm citing you like all throughout this paper, because it really affirmed that for me, I've always been interested in looking at it from a critical perspective, and you use that language, you know, and looking at it, not just as, because what I find to be problematic is this idea of, and I'll just name it as white educators. And like you stated, it applies to both, right? But white educators using it as a tool to manage their classrooms and to control students, mm-hmm. you know, and that's not, I'm not generalizing it to all of, you know, the white educators that are doing this work, but it's problematic because it exists and it just constantly perpetuates this harm that's often unspoken, you know, and it relates back to this, colonialist thinking and not really looking at how much it influences their behavior. Because one of the things I noticed is that, you know, one of your co-authors talked about co-opting restorative justice in higher ed. And the more I looked at it, I said, well, co-opting seems to be a natural occurrence for people who aren't critically aware of how, you know, whiteness influences their behavior and their interactions with other people. And so I really appreciated how you gave example after example. You know, it's not just saying this is what I observed, but you actually shared how you would tell, coach a teacher and say, you know, why don't you do this? But then it was still some pushback. So can you speak to like how you process that and those interactions?
Yeah, thank you so much, Tomei. I really appreciate it. It's interesting because going in to do ethnographic work, which is how I position my work, because I feel as though when we're going into places as a researcher and we're wanting to engage in a restorative approach, to me, doing it through sort of this quantitative focus doesn't you know allow to develop the kinds of relationships that are necessary to really have a restorative relationship with the schools that I work with. But at the same time, carrying the identity as a female professor of color, I'm sometimes often looked to respond to incidents of race or racism as it might come up in the classroom, whether that be implicitly or explicitly. And you know, really one of the hardest things to see and engage with are the white liberal arguments that perpetuate further racism and inequality. And seeing that oftentimes is a real challenge. And it's a challenge to respond to in a way that, you know, to sort of maintain your professional identity as well as the relationship with the teacher. And there's a lot of emotional energy that goes into it. And also seeing sometimes students, you know, firsthand the repercussions that they're dealt with because of their race or gender or identity in whichever way they're targeted. And it often leads to internalized oppression, and that's not visible. I really feel as though, working with some really fantastic and skilled teachers, whether they be teachers of color or white teachers, either way, I feel as though, you know, we need our white allies to step in and into the process. And, because the reality is that, white people or white teachers could say things in ways that people of color and teachers of color shouldn't have to. They shouldn't really have to carry that emotional burden to have to be the person that's always having to say, what they're expected to say, and to be the person sort of positioning it as that argument. So, you know, I think if we do have more white people engaging and really sharing and standing up with the kinds of radical perspectives that acknowledge their white complicity, and teaching white students to acknowledge their white complicity in perpetuating inequality, we can really get closer to engaging in a restorative approach mm-hmm. that way in our relationships with one another. So, yeah.
And just building off of that, I also really appreciated, you know, not just talking about the teachers and the school, the folks at the school who are actually leading these programs, but really the whole school and how much of a need it is for everyone, you know, down to the janitorial staff and how much, especially, you know, for school safety and different people, if you're going to have a restorative program, the need to really hold everyone in the school accountable to practicing that and what that means. Because I loved, you had a line about if it's really an isolated environment where they're practicing restorative justice, and it's, you know, it's one class and everything else about the school in other ways is still really punitive, and they still have, you know, really negative experiences sometimes with school safety or with the administrators and other teachers, how much then when you introduce a circle process that can sometimes be used instead as like this platform to target people, and that sense of community really isn't developed if it's not the importance of really the whole school adopting that and what that would look like.
Yeah, I think that's really important, Elena, what you're saying in terms of the whole school approach. And I really did. And I know people have written so widely about this. And I can't affirm even more than it is so true that you really do need your peers to be on board, and your principal and vice principal, and having support from mentors along the way. Because, you know, a lot of the teachers I worked with were teachers who had been trained sometimes for a year, sometimes 3 years, and in some cases for 20 years, they felt as though they've been practicing this kind of approach, but without having sort of someone to be there to have conversations with, having mentorship and guidance, you can kind of get lost in the process. And, you know, there was one teacher that I worked with who was so incredibly skilled and really took her restorative training seriously and really wanted to try it out, is how she described it. And, you know, she held circles all the time, gave opportunities for her students to share. And, you know, the classroom itself was a very transient student population. There was, it was a large refugee community and students were coming in and out, and she provided a wonderful space for her students to engage. And, you know, there was one circle where there was a student who hadn't spoken English in the class at all. He was learning to speak English, and he spoke for the first time when the talking piece was passed to him. And all the students in the class, his peers, immediately just started clapping, and everyone, you know, that affirmation. So that community was there, and it was so beautiful to be able to see that happen. At the same time, this teacher, as you know, over the course of the year, her students opened up and started to share things that they were experiencing. And she started to feel inadequate. She started to feel ill-equipped, and she was working sort of alone in her school. There were a few others trained, but they weren't practicing in the same way she was. And her principal was loosely aware, but wasn't really on board. And, you know, she started to describe what she felt, you know, as being internally conflicted with managing students' emotional and personal experiences. And she came to me and she said, you know, I don't feel like I'm a child psychologist. And, you know, I was speaking to my sister-in-law, who is a child psychologist. And she's like, why are you doing this? This isn't your job. Your job is to teach the students. That isn't to, you know, help them with their problems. And you shouldn't be doing that. And, you know, she sort of felt compelled to pull back and didn't want to go as deep as she was getting as deeply as she could have gone. So that was sort of interesting to observe, you know. When we're thinking about how do we support teachers to really manage the kinds of conversations that are possible in classes, when, you know, they receive a lot of top-down and societal expectations that they should just be focused on the curriculum, they should be just focused on, you know, maintaining you know, the student's average so that they can, you know, graduate and move on, but without paying attention to their feelings is really tricky. Whereas, you know, there was another classroom that I was recently in, and it was a grade six teacher. And she asked her students to share, you know, what their priorities were in the class. And a bunch of them raised their hands to say, you know, our teacher says that learning comes second in our class. Learning isn't our priority here. Our first priority is our relationships with each other. And it's how we're feeling, and it's what we're experiencing. And there was one class where, because part of doing ethnographic work is you sort of show up and you see what's happening. And you know, two students had come in from recess and they had a fight, and, you know, they it was over soccer. And she pulled them aside and did a restorative conference with them immediately while other students were there, and then brought the whole class together. And then they had a conversation, and people were bringing up different things, and their math period was gone, and they didn't get to do math that day, but the next day they did, and they were all focused at that time because they had come to a place where they were able to share what they were experiencing. The two boys ended that class in a hug with each other, and, you know, it doesn't mean that it always works out that way, and it doesn't, but that's just one example of how you can really, you know, pay attention enough and be attuned enough as an educator to have that sort of intuition to know when you can pause and really engage in the kind of relational connection that's necessary before you move on with the curriculum instruction overall. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just how important it is for not just those students, but the other students to really know that that type of learning is just as valued. It's like, yes, absolutely. You know, that it's important to get that math curriculum in. But if there's an issue that's at the forefront, you know, and it's going to be distracting to those students, to the other students, they're aware. All of the students are aware of these dynamics going on all the time. And it's like, how much learning is postponed regardless of if it's addressed or not, and how much, you know, how much you can prevent in further damage, and just creating those relationships by like taking those moments, like you said, and pausing and really taking advantage of, here's an opportunity and let's show why this can be powerful.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah. I just wanted to, so this book is like, I'm just going to show this. It's totally, the chapter is like, this is on every page. I'm telling you. And I've read the other chapters for, I went back especially and read Edwards of the other authors that we interviewed, and they were all good. But this one, when I tell you, like, it just landed right in my heart. And especially from my positionality and my experience, one of the things that I was able to recall was being in, I went to parochial school and I was in fourth grade. And I remember being beat with the paddle by the teacher in front of the entire classroom. And what was happening at the time was, what people didn't know was I was already experiencing my own harm at home. So to experience that in school, it just reinforced to this fourth grader that this is what happens to you, you know, and this is what happens if you speak up. You know, this is why, you know, I think it was really important to see how you really express, you know, lifting up the voices of those who are marginalized, you know. And then this one line that I love. You said, clearly restorative practices are not only about implementing particular tools or strategies, they are also about an ethos that relies on mutual respect, listening, and the commitment to confront and speak one's truth, no matter how decentering that truth is. That is powerful. Can you please speak more to that?
Yeah. Thank you, Tomi, for sharing that. That really means a lot to me. Yeah, it has always been really important to me to you know, think about how we can create inclusive spaces for young people. And, you know, schooling shouldn't be a place that is punitive and controlled. And, you know, when incidents occur in the classroom, there are so many different ways in which it's taken up. And though what teachers do in the moment could really shift an entire student's, young person's world, you know, depending on what they choose to do. And it feels like too often there are missed opportunities to engage in the kind of authentic and critical dialogue that will allow young people to really show their true self and to thrive in ways in which it's possible. And, you know, when the classroom is one of those places where the dominant way of thinking gets reinforced, it really leads to further exclusion. And I think, you know, restorative justice and restorative work is not just about, it's not just about relationships. It is also about the curriculum. And that's something that I always continuously try to, you know, encourage people to think about as well, because when we're looking at a curriculum that's delivered in a top-down manner, that's not paying attention to, you know, an inclusive history, an inclusive world, we really are continuing to perpetuate inequality. And, you know, so if we can create a classroom and create spaces where there's a continual attention to power and to difference, you know, we can really support our young learners. And, you know, but I think, you know, we also need to equip teachers with the sort of the tools that they need to facilitate the kind of dialogue that is possible, to, you know, create the individuals we need who will build the society that we want. So, you know, training teachers to use alternative methods is obviously challenging within a constrained context of schooling. But I think through professional development, through coaching, we can really create the world that is possible to have really close relationships with our students, but also really high expectations that will allow them to thrive.
Yeah. Mm. So I want to be mindful of time. And if there's other things that you want to share, I would love to hear. But I do have one kind of bigger picture question, in really hoping that this, I know you've been doing this work for a long time, and I hope that you've seen positive changes over the years of how this has been incorporated in classrooms and different ways that teachers and whole school environments are continuing to be more inclusive, knowing that there's still a long way to go. What would you say 5 years from now, how would those classrooms be, what would that look like for the classroom and the school to be operating in a more, in a way that there's not as many students who are in and out of those circles? What are some of the ways that those classrooms would look differently?
Yeah, that's a really great question, Elena. I think, yeah, you know, they say that it takes like, you know, 3 years for the process to really see differences. But I personally think that immediately after witnessing some teachers being trained and the ways in which they take it up in their classrooms, you really do see some immediate changes, because they're like, wow, I really do need to step back, or I really can, if I do have this relational connection with my students, things happen differently. You know, learning happens differently. Learning actually accelerates because we're able to have deep connections with each other. At the same time, I don't think we can expect restorative justice and circle processes specifically to, as some people might hope, to automatically facilitate nonviolence or mutual respect and inclusion, even though those are things that people think, okay, well, I have this training and you know, we have circles, so it will automatically happen. But preparing students and preparing teachers for the process is critical to ensuring that the principles are respected in circle. And, you know, whether that be, you know, choosing the right topics and through preparatory circles, preparatory phases, having a number of small community circles prior to engaging in conflict is another aspect. But at the same time, I also think that the importance of engaging in conflict is really important, and not shying away from thinking about social justice issues as well is really, really important. And you know, I think in terms of political ideologies, for instance, I just actually finished wrapping up a course on political ideologies for first year students, and it was really amazing to see them grappling with their political identities. And that is something that young people continue to do. And they bring that into the classroom. They love discussing current events. And, you know, when they come into the classroom and they bounce around what they've learned at home, what they're seeing online, what their friends are saying, then what their teachers or their professors are saying. And it really gives birth to new ideologies and new ways of thinking. And, you know, if we're just looking at what's happened in 2020, for instance, and thinking about how ideologies are born out of crisis, you know, when we're looking at speaking with young people about the murder of George Floyd and Breonna Taylor, and, you know, COVID's disproportionate impact on communities of color, climate crises, you know, young people witnessing and participating in protests in the streets. And these events really do have people latching on to new ideologies and digging in. And I think that by creating a safe platform for discussion for young people, we provide an opportunity for them to be heard, and we provide an opportunity for change to take place. And without that kind of place where they can speak and they can share what they're experiencing, they can advocate for each other, really, young people can go on feeling unheard. And when that happens, their basic needs aren't being met that need to be heard, and conflict escalates. And, you know, some young people then find themselves immersed in online communities, for instance, where they get egged on in their views and dig in deeper, and conflicts could escalate through there. And that's why, you know, I think the solution lies in equipping young people with tools with what I describe in my work as dialogic pedagogies, or conflict dialogue, from a very young age. And, it, you know, it's about finding people who actually disagree with you and learning how to engage in civil dialogue. And so it's not about being isolated. And it's certainly not about finding people who will egg you on, no matter how extreme or exclusionary your view is, but about engaging in a shared dialogue. And I think through an all-hands community approach, whether that be, you know, teachers, social workers, all community service professionals, you know, in the case of young people, you know, adults who can be there to have strong connections with young people. Because I think, you know, research tells us that when young people feel as though they have strong adult allies and connections, they are much more likely to feel safe and included. And, you know, making sure that top-down approaches are replaced with a restorative approach in all interactions with young people, whether that be in their, whether they're teaching or they're coming into the classroom and you're dealing with an interpersonal conflict. I think that, you know, restorative justice is really a critical response to responding to young people and interacting with young people. So, and I think that with successful implementation, in whether we have in 5 years from today or in the future, I think that it really can do what we hope to do, you know, reduce incidents of conflict, of violence, of racism, and focus on, you know, maybe redirecting young people who could potentially be subject to radicalization as well because of perpetual exclusions. And that's, you know, and one approach could be to engage in circle processes in classrooms, bringing people together, talking about what has happened, talking about their needs, talking about suggestions of how to go on. And while that process is useful and inclusive and works wonderfully for many students, but also, you know, being mindful that any dialogic exchange, in any dialogic exchange, power dynamics are bound to come up and could play out in destructive ways. So paying attention to that and identifying creative ways to name such dynamics and teaching young people to name those dynamics as well, to create norms for engagement and how we can really empower each other through a restorative approach. So, yeah, I think, you know, it is all possible, but, and I do believe that if continual attention to looking at proactive measures could really create the kind of society that we know is possible.
Thank you so much. This has been so wonderful. And I don't know if Tomei, if you have anything else you wanted to ask or.
No, I can't because I can't keep her here
for another 3 hours.
No, I'm really grateful for the work that you've been doing over the last 12 years or so. And what your chapter again, because it's informing so many perspectives and ways of being. I think that's the essence of it, to get us to make restorative a way of being and not just an act, you know, or one-off in a certain setting or for a specific situation. But like you said, to just have it inclusive and incorporated, integrated into everything we do. I often tell people I use it even with my spouse. You know, if something comes up, we sit and have a restorative conversation. You know, because we're both practitioners, so we believe. And the reason why we call ourselves practitioners, one, is because we do the work, but we practice it daily. Mm. We practice it daily. Even when I come across conflict with someone else and I have to sit and think about, well, what was I thinking at the time? You know, what was happening? What was I feeling? What was I experiencing? How was I triggered? And how did I possibly trigger somebody else? You know, just having that conversation with myself has been powerful in how I show up in spaces. So, but I'm going to continue, you know, diving into the entire book, but because I clearly like painted your chapter blue with highlight, you know, so I'm just grateful for this interview with you.
Yeah. Thanks so much to me for what you said. Yeah. I think it's really important. You know, I think, you know, and my 4-year-old was facilitating a circle this morning with a talking piece. You know, it's just, he's like, I like to have, and he brought it out and he, you know, made sure that everyone had their chance to speak. And even this little one here, who's 2.5, was asking for her turn as well. So
I was just going to say, your 2.5-year-old is incredibly She's put in her time of, she's like, okay, now I need to move around a little bit, but she's great. Well, this was really great. And Yeah, I think both of us have a million more questions and things that we would love to continue talking about, but hope to continue this conversation again in the future. We really appreciate your time.
Yeah, I really appreciated this conversation. Thank you so much, both of you. It was so great. Great to meet you and speak with you today.
Great to meet you too.
Yeah. Thank you.
Okay.
Thanks so much, Christina.
Okay.
All right. Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Thank you for taking time to be here with us today. And we hope you stay tuned for our next episode. And for more information about Colorizing Restorative Justice or contacting the authors or learning more about the National Center on Restorative Justice and our partner organizations, please go and check out the link in our bio.
This project is supported by grant number 2020-MUCX-K001, awarded by the Bureau of Justice Assistance. The Bureau of Justice Assistance is a component of the U.S. Department of Justice's Office of Justice Programs, which also includes the Bureau of Justice Statistics, the National Institute of Justice, the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention, the Office for Crimes, Victims of Crime, and the Smart Office. Points of view, images, or opinions in this document and are those of the author do not necessarily represent the official position or policies of the U.S. Department of Justice.